And it's Matthew chapter 13, verses 24 to 43. Jesus told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. When the wheat sprouted and formed ears, then the weeds also appeared. The owner's servants came to him and said, "Sir, didn't you sow good seed in your field? Where then did the weeds come from?" "An enemy did this," he replied. The servants asked him, "Do you want us to go and pull them up?" "No," he answered, "because while you are pulling the weeds, you may root up the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. At that time I will tell the harvesters, 'First collect the weeds and tie them in bundles to be burned. Then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn.'" He told them another parable. "The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field. Though it is the smallest of all your seeds, yet when it grows, it is the largest of garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and perch in its branches." He told them still another parable. "The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into a large amount of flour until it worked all through the dough." Jesus spoke all these things to the crowd in parables. He did not say anything to them without using a parable. So was fulfilled what was spoken through the prophet, "I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things hidden since the creation of the world." Then he left the crowd and went into the house. His disciples came to him and said, "Explain to us the parable of the weeds in the field." He answered, "The one who sowed the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed stands for the sons of the kingdom. The weeds are the sons of the evil one, and the enemy who sows them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the harvesters are angels. As the weeds are pulled up and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. They will throw them into the fiery furnace, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father." He who has ears, let him hear.
Father, as we think of these seeds sown, and as we think of what we've just sung about being planted so that we take deep root, we ask that we would grow in strength to follow you and not to follow other voices that we hear. Amen. Well, last week we started looking at these parables in chapter 13 and Matthew 13, and we said that these parables are sort of an opportunity in the gospel, a lot's happened already, to take stock. So Jesus, as we've seen, as these encounters he's had, he breaks expectations. And some of his hearers, because of the way that's happened, is their confidence is now low. This is not what they've expected. And maybe our confidence is low. Because in the Bible, we read bits where it tells us that Jesus is the eternal King, that he's sovereign over all things. His kingdom is unshakable and expansive and eternal. And our experience is anything but. And if you think that, you're in good company. A while ago, we looked at Matthew 11. The start of that, John the Baptist is in prison and he sends his disciples to ask Jesus, "Are you the one? Should we be expecting another one?" Simply, what was happening is John the Baptist was looking at his Old Testament, his Bible, as far as he's concerned, and he thought, Jesus is taking his time. Evil's not been conquered. The captives are not all freed. And through the Gospels, there's a common response among others, which is, this is not quite what we expected. And so the parables explain what we read in the Bible is true, and yet we experience what we do. The two things are not in conflict. And we noticed that this morning we're talking about three parables and the prophecy of verse 35. And hopefully it's clear why I took on so much in one go. When I was preparing it at the beginning of the week, I was thinking, what was I thinking when I planned this? So first a reminder, and then it will become clear what I was thinking. First a reminder, last week we looked at verses 1 to 23, the parable of the sower, or the soils, as some people like to call it. And in the centre of that parable is a bit from Isaiah, and explaining why Jesus uses parables. It explains that they act as a sort of a filtering or a sieve. So it's about responses, and that section acts as an introduction to the parables. So you had a parable, an explanation of a parable, and then in the middle, this bit about why parables. And then there's a series of pairs about aspects about the kingdom. So the first pair is the first and the last of the parables after that, so verses 24 to 30 and 47 to 52. So that's the wheat and the weeds and the net. They're all about the final day. It's actually tied in quite well with the big question. And the second and the third parables, verses 31 to 45, is the mustard seed and the yeast. That's all about the kingdom starting very small and growing. And the fourth and fifth, in verses 44 to 45, is the treasure and the pearl. It's all about the value. You really want this kingdom. So we deal with responses, and then it's about the end, the growth and value. And we notice here a bit of a structure, that sometimes what you need to do as a preacher is just focus on one idea, but sometimes the message is in the connections. So, and that's why I've bitten off so much today. So we notice there's the parable of the weeds is told, and then it's explained. And, you know, I've said before, I haven't said it for a while, I don't think, but, you know, chapter 4 is after chapter 3, but before chapter 5, this is advanced Bible maths, about what's in the middle of something. So it's not just that it's after something, but in the middle of something. So you have the parable told, then the parable explained, then in the middle you have, between the telling and the explaining, are two more parables and another explanation of why Jesus told parables. So these ideas are connected, and there's something significant in the connection. They explain each other. So the first thing is why these parables, and that's in verses 34 to 35. So I'll read them to you. Jesus spoke all these things to the crowd in parables. He did not say anything to them without using a parable. So was fulfilled what was spoken through the prophet. I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things hidden since the creation of the world. So what you've got there is a quote from Psalm 78 of Asaph. And it seems odd when you first read Psalm 78 in one go, which we won't do now, because it's quite straightforward. Now, the other week we're rejoicing with Stefan and Sally, who probably gave the most in all this, is he got his PhD in the Psalms. And Stefan's PhD is basically on those Psalms. When you first read them, you go, what do I do with that? And so if you read a Psalm and think that, go and ask Stefan. Or for someone to give him his money back. So why are these psalms there? These are hard psalms, and that's what he did a lot of study on. Psalm 78 is not one of those psalms. You read that and you go, well, that's straightforward. That's not PhD stuff, is it? This is a straightforward psalm. It's a song of praise, retelling Israel's history of God's saving acts and events that you will be familiar with, no doubt. But Psalm 78, verse 2, slight spanner in the works, it says, parables, that the psalm is parables and utterances of hidden things. So it's very straightforward, but says it's not straightforward. It's parables and utterances of things hidden. So what you have is, in that psalm, is Old Testament history. And this Old Testament history points us to Jesus and the cross and the resurrection. And yet, all this was widely missed. In the Old Testament times themselves, people were reading their Bibles, their Old Testaments, and they missed some obvious things that were going on around them. It's all there, but it's hidden in plain sight. And this comes back to some of our things on Thursday nights. it's tied in quite well with the big question. This actually ties in quite well with what we're looking at tonight in Ecclesiastes and Thursdays. And I've got to put my hand up and say that was all by accident. But it does tie in very well. But thinking about some of the stuff we've already seen on Thursday night is that people make certain assumptions through their experiences or through their existing commitments to what they think about how things are, how they read events. They often read the Bible through that and therefore miss the point. And what people really need is the work of the Spirit. And so also in Psalm 78, it's not really thought of as a prophecy. And yet that's what Matthew calls it in verse 35, a prophecy. But prophecy doesn't just mean prediction, but also revealing something hidden. So just as Asaph did in Psalm 78, so Jesus does in his ministry and in these parables, and says in verse 34, he always used them. And so these parables show that what the Old Testament promised and yet was hidden in plain sight. So, sort of hidden, but not hidden. In Jesus' work and his ongoing work today, he makes these things plain. So his kingdom appears hidden, but it is there. It's small and then it grows. And in the end, that's all there is. And that's what connects all these ideas, is the idea of small, growing, and in the end, that's all there is. And what we see is that this is a great encouragement. I think that's why it's here in Matthew 13. And as you leave today, I suppose that's what I want you to get, is an encouragement. But also, and not insignificantly, it's a warning and an invitation as well. So let's take a look at the parables. The small and growing, and in the end, that's all there is. So firstly, that it's small but growing. So what we've got is these two short parables show that. The kingdom is not only small, it's imperceptible. You can hardly see it at all. And it's swamped by all other things, and yet it has a very big impact. So firstly is the mustard seed in verses 31 to 32. It says, he told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field. Through it is the smallest of all your seeds, yet when it grows, it is the largest of garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and perch in its branches. So mustard seeds are tiny. They're the smallest known to their hearers. And the plant ends up as a significant shrub or a tree large enough for birds to perch in it. So the kingdom is unnoticeably small when it's sown, and you go out the next morning and you notice nothing different from when you sowed it. But over time, eventually, it becomes this significant, substantial plant, certainly something you'd notice in your garden. The next parable is the yeast in verse 33. He told them still another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into a large amount of flour until it worked all through the dough. Now, that's an interesting parable because normally yeast in the Bible is a negative thing. Yeast is something you don't want working its way through. And that's why, because the idea of yeast is that it is pervasive. It works its way through. It's often used as an illustration for influence. So something bad works its way through and infects everything else. And that's why in extreme circumstances, slightly different in the Old Testament in how it works out in the New, but it talks about people being cut out of God's people so that the sin doesn't spread, it doesn't infect others with the ultimate aim of bringing them back. But here, the kingdom is like yeast. It's used in a good way, but in the same way, in as far as it is pervasive, it works its way through. So you put this small amount in, this tiny dust, if you've ever used yeast, it normally comes like a sort of a dust, that you put in to make your bread. I used to make pizzas with Josiah, and you put in a little bit in the dough, and you come, nothing happens very much. Come back an hour later, and your little bit of dough has become a lot of dough. When I brew beer, 40 pints, just a teaspoon of yeast has an impact on 40 pints of beer. So a little thing has a substantial effect, but it takes time. In about a week with beer, an hour when you make a pizza base, it takes time. You don't put it in, it just goes. That's the point, though. It's a little bit, big impact, takes a bit of time. And that's also why anti-Christian groups want to cut Christians out. So the most extreme version I know is North Korea, where if you have find out that a foreigner is a Christian and he's spoken to, or she's spoken to other Koreans, maybe one of those has become a Christian, they expel the foreigner, kill the Christian, kill their parents, and kill their children. Why? Because they don't want the yeast to spread. They don't want it to be pervasive. So the North Koreans, ironically, have understood this and understood covenant theology better than we have. They cut it out. Now, there's a controversy that goes with this, because everyone likes a bit of controversy at some point, don't they? So I'll tell you the 2 points of the controversy and then give you the right answer. So now, among churches like us, and we all think we're very eclectic, but we're not. Churches like us, by which I mean sort of evangelicals, independent or Presbyterian or sort of Reformed Anglicans, those kind of people, they recognise that there's this problem you get in more liberal churches where you adjust the message or the technique to accommodate culture. So it works like, they say, we've got to do what people can cope with. So culture does not like talk about sin, certainly not judgment, and it can't accept miracles because I've not seen any. And we're so scientific and clever now. So just remove them. Just take them out because people can't accept them. And what you end up with is just the form. No content, just form. And then we find that our culture doesn't like that either, so we have to change that. And now we all think that's wrong. Evangelicals have noticed that that is wrong, although it would be naive to think we're not affected by that. But more recently, there's been a bit of a debate. I don't know how long this is going on for, but it's sort of coming a bit to a head at the moment, between different evangelicals. Some say we need to impact our culture. So what we need to do is get into government. The focus at the moment is a lot about art, making an impact on literature and art and music, and that will impact the way people think, so we get them ready for the gospel. And others say, no, don't worry about culture. Culture is irrelevant or neutral or something. The gospel is always relevant. It is always understandable. So leave the culture alone. It's not our problem. Now, here's the right answer. I'm not going to give you the wrong one, am I? It's actually, they're both a bit right, and they're both very wrong. And funny enough, when I've got some friends who represent both of those, and after talking to me, they're both saying, but Darren's our man, Darren agrees with us. No, you weren't listening, I was disagreeing with both of you. We don't have to prepare our culture, we sow the seed, but as you put the yeast in, it pervades everything. And it pervades our culture. It grows, it spreads, and its impact works its way into society. So in both parables, the kingdom is very small, even unnoticeable. Its growth is not visible. It is slow. And yet you look away, or you go away and do something else, and you come back, there's been huge growth. And that's meant as an encouragement. Because the gospel seems weak, and at times, as Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians, it seems silly even. Churches feel small and powerless. We often feel like that, don't we? When we've got quite a small building, and when we're very full, we go, wow, we're really full. Two or three families are away, and then we go, it's all been empty. We're very easily discouraged, and it seems small and silly and weak and pointless. It seems like a hopeless task. But what we're told here is be patient. It is working. It is happening. But invisibly, but it ends up being very big. And I gave an example last week about Philip Hacking, who was a minister in Sheffield. And each year, he said it was just hard work with discouragements. And at his retirement, he just sort of looked out and went, where did all these people come from? He'd been there for a while and realised that quite a big church had grown up when he hadn't really been noticing. So the theme is that the kingdom is small, but it's growing. And that in the end, that's all there is, verses 24 to 30 and 36 to 43. So Jesus tells the parable of the weeds in verses 24 to 30. Then there's the bit we've just looked at, the two parables and the explanation of parables, that it's what is hidden is then revealed. And then the weeds are explained in verses 36 to 43. And the explanation of the wheat and the weeds is about the kingdom is revealed on the last day. And that idea is repeated again a bit later in verses 47 to 52 about the parable of the net, which we'll look at in a few weeks. So a legitimate question is, if the kingdom is so great, if its impact on its subjects is so significant, if it's so pervasively working through the dough that it affects our culture, then why are there problems in the world? Well, back to our earlier question echoed by John the Baptist. We notice historically that the growth of Christianity brings with it a number of improvements to what goes on. You know, we think of our own country of labour laws, the end of slavery, equality laws, even the treatment of animals. And yet, as such things happen, they bring with them a load of new problems. So I used to live near the top of the Welsh border, near there, and you drive around North Wales, and there's lots of evidence around for all the revivals. There are chapels everywhere. And what are they now? The population of Wales has gone up, and yet there are not more churches. All these chapels from the revivals are now holiday cottages, carpet warehouses, and boutique antique shops. Why doesn't it solve our problems? Why doesn't it always stick, this kingdom business? Well, there's an explanation. The sower of the good seed is Jesus in verse 37. The good seed is the church, verse 38. The field is the world in verse 38. The enemy is the devil in verse 39. And the bad seed is everyone else in verse 38. And then the harvest is at the end of history, where there's a judgment, and the harvesters are the angels. Notice a few things that seem to surprise some people. The first thing is it's not about the church. It's not a parable about the church. Often it's told to explain that in the church there are people who are not true believers, as it will later on emerge. That isn't the point. In verse 38, the field is the world. The second thing to notice is that it is very black and white. This is very bottom line kind of stuff. Either you are subject of the king or you are a rebel against him. You may be a passive rebel, or you may be an aggressive rebel, but you are a rebel. So you're either wheat or a weed. There's no category for a misplaced tulip or something like that. But also notice where the weeds are. The weeds are where the devil sows them, exactly where the good seed is. Where the wheat will grow, there is where the weeds will grow. And that will include in the church. But it shows there's always opposition to the kingdom, wherever it appears. It could be aggressive opposition, it could be other problems appearing. But the point of the parable is, for now, God leaves it alone. He lets them grow together. How can you tell which is which if you were a neutral, which there is no such thing, but if you were a neutral bystander, how would you know which is which? How can you tell which will have the upper hand in the end? Well, you can't tell. We've seen the kingdom start small, it grows invisibly. When it is seen for what it is, when will it be seen for what it is? Well, it's the last day. Verses 40 to 43. As the weeds are pulled up and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. They will throw them into the fiery furnace, where there will be a weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear. So in the last day, there will be a division. And that division is not random. The wheat, the sons of the kingdom, will shine like the sun. And the weeds will be burned up in everlasting fire. So two things to bear in mind and to notice. The sons of the kingdom are called righteous. It's not a parable, but a wider point to remember. So it's not in the parable, but it's a wider point to remember that these righteous are no better. They're made right by their king when they're made kingdom subjects. And that's the difference. It's not how good we are, but one group present their own good deeds and are found wanting. The other are clothed in Jesus' righteousness. One group shoulders the penalty for their own sin. The other place it on Jesus. The other thing, more significant in the parable, is that power is displayed at the end. power's displayed at the end. So the trend in our culture, and which has come into the church, is that wisdom and power has to be displayed now. So everyone says, wow, what an amazing thing you've got, and be convinced. The byproduct, or in this case, that they will all come, so by my product, or in this case, come into church because of all this wisdom and power I've got. The point of the parable is that the kingdom is only really seen at the end of time. By faith, we know it's invisibly growing, but it's hidden from sight for now, but not at the end. So the central verses in verses 34 to 35, that quote from Psalm 78, verse 2, is that through the parables and Jesus' ministry, what is hidden in plain sight will then be revealed. And then the three parables, the weeds, the mustard seed and the yeast, is shown that the kingdom is unremarkable and small and weak. It is powerless, even imperceptible. But slowly and invisibly it grows until that is all there is. So last week we saw the sower or the soils, and there was an encouragement, keep going, don't give up. It's like when we sow in our own gardens, you know, you don't go out and give up because there's no shrubs that birds can go in the day after you've sowed. Or yeast through the dough, you don't glare at it until you notice a difference. You won't notice. You go away, come back in an hour, you notice the difference. Or if it's beer or wine, you come back a week later, you notice a difference. Be patient. It's small when it starts, but it goes into something that is very big and significant. So not only don't give up, but we need to think and pray much bigger than we do. Don't be discouraged because an outreach event has small numbers, or fewer people one week than the next at church, or even in a year. But at the same time, expect and pray and plan towards very big things from God. So the big thing here is an encouragement, but also a warning and an invitation. Last week, we left with this thought of, well, which soil are you? Are you the not listening, or the shallow, or the distracted, or the listening? This week is more pointed. Which seed are you? There are two destinations, shine with the Father, or burn in the furnace. We can protest about the fairness, but that is the bottom line of how it is in the parable. And the simple issue is not, do you think it's fair? The simple issue is it true? My comfort about it is no measure of whether it is true. And elsewhere in the Bible, it does explain the fairness of it. But the point of the parable here is there are two kinds of people. Those who poodle on quite happily for now, but on the last day, there will be a difference which will be revealed. Whatever their circumstances now, one will spend eternity shining like the Father, and the other an eternity in death and punishment. And that's not really how they appear now, which is why a choice must be made now. You can't change the group then, it's too late. This life has a purpose, and this is the purpose. Which group are you in? If you needed persuasion that outreach matters, well, here it is. Here, there are two options that must be made known to other people. Which destiny are they choosing? Which destiny are you choosing? If rejecting the kingdom is worth doing in an informed way, as the stakes are so high. So it's an encouragement as well, though. Be patient. The growth will be exposed, so keep going with this. But a warning, make sure that you're in the right batch at the harvest. And so it's an invitation. Not an invitation to lose out and to lose yourself, but to know God now, so that when you meet him, and you will, you do so as a rescued friend. As Jesus closes in this parable, so will I. He who has ears, let him hear. Let's pray. Father, we ask your Spirit would work in our hearts, that this seed would bear fruit in us, that it would grow, that you would make us patient, and most of all, that you would soften the hearts of those who need it to accept the invitation. Amen.